Down to business on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland. We understand business. Choose the bank that's here to help you rise to today's business challenges and tomorrow's.
And we're bringing you a very special show from Killarney for the EY Entrepreneur of the Year annual CEO retreat from the Europe Hotel in Killarney. Loads still to come, including an enthralling discussion with four businesswomen about the changing nature of women in business. Mountaineer Pat Falvey on climbing the world's highest peaks and coming back down to earth, plus the CEO of OnPost, David McRedmond. Now, let's go to the mountains. Now, as we're in Killarney, I've taken a trip slightly off-piste, and I'm out here with a legend in these parts, a legend in many parts, Mr. Pat Falvey. He's an adventurer, he's an explorer, he's a businessman, he's an entrepreneur, he's a public speaker, and I'm actually here at his house. I've called out to Pat's house here in Beaufort in Killarney. Pat Falvey, you're very welcome to the programme.
Well, thanks a lot, Bobby, and welcome to my house. It's called Explorer's Mountain Lodge.
Okay.
And you'll see why in a minute. There's lots of memorabilia from every part of the world. But the reason why I picked it here, it's on the base of six of Ireland's highest mountain. And look, if you look out the back door there, I can actually walk 3 days to Waterville without ever coming off the mountain.
Wow.
And that's one of the reasons why I came here. But more than that, look, if you look out, the scenery here is fantastic. This is this place has an epicenter, like it has an energy. And it took me years to find it. And when I found it, I could feel the energy in the place. But it overlooks right from Dingle, Mount Brandon, all the ways back.
Yeah.
And over where you're staying at the moment in the Europe Hotel and the lake, Loch Lean, which is the Lake of Learning. It's where the Isles of Innisfallen have been written. And, you know, to me, I travel the world for 7 months every year for the last 30 years on expedition, you know, and I come back here and it's the tranquility, the
peaceful
peace.
Place.
Yeah.
And what a view, Pat. And again, I know this is radio, but just to describe to our listeners, we're looking out here, we're on the side of a mountain, looking out across the most beautiful greenery, the lake in the distance. I can see why this is your place of peace. Pat, I walking through the house when we came up here early this morning, I just saw some amazing memorabilia, your own memorabilia about your various conquests, your various adventures. Maybe we might go inside and you might just describe one or two of them.
Yeah, I will. And a lot of these are used as vision boards, by the way, like, you know, for the people I travel with are actually emulates. So I'll just go in here. Like, as you can see in this hall, you know, like you have everybody like that that would have come to the house, like Mary McAleese, Martin, like the president when she was president at the time. And then you'd have like one of the ones I really love is this one up here, because I'm a really fan of David Attenborough. And this is where I was doing an icon series, and in England I became one of the five icons there, and that was David Attenborough, Ronald Fiennes, Chris Bonington and Jim McNeil.
Right.
Like, you know, Jim is a polar person. He was here last week with me.
Chris Bonington, he's the Bovril man.
He's the Bovril man. You remember that. You're of the same age, like, you know. Do you drink your Bovril? Be big and strong.
I also see here, Pat, that somebody called you the accidental rebel. What's that about?
The accidental rebel, like, what happened is I come from a poor background. I lived in a council house. I was defined by my locality. If you come in here, and I suppose the easiest thing to do is to describe it. Why it was an accidental rebel. Look, this is me, the snotty nose. This is actually pictures from all around the house. But, you know, this was a snotty nose 12-year-old that had his first job. And this pram hair, that was my first business.
Wow.
And I went around 5,000 council houses, collected the clothes, brought them to the Coal Quay in Cork. My grandmother was a dealer. Not a drug dealer now, like a clothes dealer.
Dealer of
and
clothes.
And she actually sold the clothes. And believe it or not, it was my first collaboration.
Yeah.
And then what happened is, by the time I was 12, I had £750 in the bank in 1969, which is the price of quarter of a house. So what happened is people told me when I was 15, then I left school to become a millionaire because my dad's business went wrong. And this is where the rebel came in. Everybody, my teachers and everyone told me like I was a dope. And to define myself, I just told them if you could use the analogy, in other words, F off, right, okay? I have a dream. I'm a dreamer. And so I just kept following my dreams. And lo and behold, by the time I was 20, I was a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
I couldn't read or write. And look, if you look here, this is a house we have in Cork. I had that built and paid for at 20 without being able to read or write.
Wow.
It's a big Georgian house. It's about 5,000 square feet. So what happened after that, like, people kept on telling me I couldn't do stuff because I was a dope or because I came from an area. So I tell people all the time, like, do not be defined by what people see you as.
Or where you come from.
Yeah, so then I became known as a rebel. And then, like, in actual fact, in my early days, I was quite ruthless. And a lot of people, you know, can be very ruthless. But I started hurting people I didn't mean to hurt. As you would do in business, like, you know, you'll always step on somebody. So as I came through, you know, I changed my name from the rebel to being the accidental rebel. And then I mellowed after I tried to take my life through suicide after going broke, went out to find myself in the Himalayas. At that stage, believe it or not, I had no interest in capitalism. I decided I was going to become a dropped out hippie smoking pot in Dubar Square. And then my Buddhist monks, mentors, right, okay, they said, Pat, you have too much to offer, like, you know. Like, Buddhism isn't about that. And I said, but what about, like, if I'm a capitalist and, you know, making all this money and becoming unfair? And they said, no, do what you can do. But then they said, share it. So I came back from Kathmandu, believe it or not, as a social capitalist. And that meant to help others. So, like, 20% of everything I would earn would go to helping others.
Yeah.
So, and, you know...
What age were you when you found climbing, Pat?
29.
Okay.
And resilience is an innate aspect in all of us. We all have it, no matter who we are. Like, I know you went through your own tough times and your own tough times. And, like, you know, and here I have John alongside of me producing. And I know everybody has done it. So I was at the stage where most people are vulnerable. You know, 29 to 40, like, it's like where you're kind of in transition. So I couldn't take the pressure and I tried to take my life through suicide. But what I didn't realize is I didn't talk. And it was because the banks came after my wife and came after me, losing self-esteem. But when I actually started talking, believe it or not, my family had my back.
Yeah.
And we all know they're the unsung heroes. The bank had my back. You know, my creditors had my back.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, one day, at that point in time, it was something I needed. A fella came into the office, said, would I go hill walking? Went hill walking, went up a mountain, and now 155 expeditions later, I'm here. And what you're doing is you're looking around. I've reenacted, like, if you know, all of the major explorers, you know, not in Ireland, but in the world.
Yeah.
Hilary and Tenzing, Marion Ervin, Scott and Amundsen, you know, and Johansson, the Hansen, like, all over the world. And what I have here in my home is a piece. Yeah.
I was going to ask you about how sort of climbing and adventure and exploration sort of saved you. What was it just the whole ambition there? You were able to channel your energy through that source as opposed to business that got you back on track?
Well, what happened is I went to nature, and like I've had, you know, a success both in adventure, exploration, and businesses all around the world. But what happened is I went out to nature and I went for a walk. And if we go outside, and this is what's happening with a lot of people, you have to breathe.
Yeah.
Like,
now, Pat, we're out here in the hall, and I think this is your area dedicated to Everest. The first thing I see is an ice pick.
But, like, if you look around, basically I use the hall. Like, I have 250,000 pictures and stuff like that. But in this little corner encapsulates a year of my life from being at base camp and trying to climb a mountain. This is actually, I became the first person in the world to climb Everest north and south.
This is from Tibet and
Nepal.
Okay.
And I was the first Irish person to lead an expedition and have a successful summit on the south side. But like, this was Hilary and Tenzing on the south side, Mallory and Ervin on the north side. But this is an amazing place. If you look at here, there's a rock, right? That rock, and I have a fossil that I brought back, but it's not here at the moment. But I found that fossil right on top of the world. And to think of the fact, right, okay, that one time I'm now standing in a place, a Cork man, an Irish man, with a tricolour, right, with my team, and you have a rock that came from the bottom of the planet. The energy that you get from that is amazing. And all of that started, by the way, when I actually came down here and I climbed Carn Tool, and my head was frazzled, and I was so excited, it was my Everest then, that I said on top of Carn Tool, yes, I'm on top of Carden Tool. And I turned to my friend and said, I'm going to climb Mount Everest. And then, you know, all these years later, not alone did I climb Mount Everest, but I went all around the world, became the first person in the world to climb Everest North and South, seven summits twice. And what you're looking at here around the wall is the memories of that. And the only reason, like when you say accidental rebel, and you come from a background that I came from, I would not be able to relate today if I didn't have these up.
Yeah.
When I look at them, living with 32 tribes, studying 18 religions, illiterate till I was 30, now I have seven books written, have two children's books written, I became a filmmaker. And like all around the walls here, which you're also looking at, is it must be remembered, I travel at the extreme of adventure and exploration. And over 32 people that I would have had friends and climbed at this level have died and given their life back, you know, for their dreams. And, you know, on top of Mount Everest, by the way, is, you know, I learned, you know, when I overtraded, and I often think about it, you know, and when I was there, like I was there twice and I was standing there and I realized that everybody has their own Everest.
Yeah.
And what it did is it opened up the opportunity for me to talk about Everest, not as a mountain, but because it gave me the accolade that I can travel all around the world and speak about, you know.
Having done that.
people say to me, freaking amazing, like that accidental rebel. What's next? And it's always about what's next. What's next for you now, Bobby? Like,
I was going to ask you that just to close out, because what is next for Pat Falvey after all you've done?
What's next for me is to become the best grandfather that I can be.
There you go. Because that's an admirable goal, I think.
Yeah.
And it's one that I think you should probably find is at peace here. It's the right thing to do. Because it's about enjoying your grandkids.
The question is, will I be able to succeed in doing that, right? Because, you know, because I travel a lot and do things like that, but I'm going to give it my best efforts. There's a great saying is that if I didn't, I would have ended up in the Robert Service end of poem, right? At the end of life, and it would have been, like if I didn't try, you know, people say when is the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago.
Yeah.
When is the next best time? Now, right? But here's one from Robert Service if I had kept going. And just remember this, because it's never too late to change, and it's always, you know, good to keep it in mind. If I had kept going the way I was going, the rootless bee that I had been in my early life, you know, I'm at peace now, I'm nearly in nirvana, but here goes. He has failed, he has failed, he has missed his chance. He's only done things by half. Now life's been a jolly good joke on him, and now it's time to laugh. Ha ha! He is one of the legions lost. He was never meant to win. He's a rolling stone and bred in the bone of the man that didn't fit in.
There you go. Pat Falvey, what a pleasure.
Well, welcome to the Mountain Lodge, and hopefully we'll get you back again.
Thank you so much, Pat. And so it's so nice to see you here on your own turf. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks a lot.
Down to business on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland. We understand business. Choose the bank that's here to help you rise to today's business challenges and tomorrow's.
I'm delighted now to be joined by four finalists, all of whom happen to be women. I'm joined by finalists Chupi Sweetman of Chupi Jewellery, Dr. Vanessa Craven and Dr. Lisa Craven of Spotlight Oral Care, and by Lulu O'Sullivan, the founder of GiftsDirect.com. We're going to chat a little bit about being a woman in business. Good morning, ladies, firstly.
Good morning. Good morning.
Now, as someone who comes from a house full of ladies, I really am going to enjoy this conversation. Chupi, I want to start with you. Firstly, tell us a little bit about your business, if you would.
So my name is Chupi. Bobby, we make beautiful diamond rings. We have a team of 60 and we sell them to 67 countries around the world.
Fantastic. And Lisa and Vanessa from Spotlight Oral Care, just one of you, I don't know which, is going to do the intro, but tell us more.
So we are an Irish oral care company called Spotlight Oral Care. Vanessa and I are sisters and dentists, and we sell oral care products across Ireland, the UK and the US.
Great. And Lulu?
So I have an e-commerce company with two brands. One is Gifts Direct, and we deliver gifts all over the world, and the other is called The Irish Store, and we deliver beautiful Irish products to the Irish diaspora.
Now, Chupi, I want to ask you, I suppose, three questions in one, and I'm going to be putting this question to all the panel. I'd like to know the advantages of being a woman in business, the disadvantages of being a woman in business, and what needs to change to make business a better place for women. All three questions in one bite. How about that?
I think the huge thing that needs to change, Bobby, is representation. We need to see it to be able to be it. I think about, for me, so when I started Chupi, we're 10 years old, and were there women like me in the room? Were there people like me in the room? And that diversity is so important. It's challenging, I think, running a business. I was very young when I started. I was 21 when I first started my business. I was worked in fashion. I'm now 37. And seeing Chupi grow up through that has been huge. It's also an advantage because there's incredible women in the room with you, like the women I'm sitting here, and there's that network that comes, and we grow stronger together.
And can I ask you about maybe disadvantages, just to talk about them bluntly, because I think people want to know what they are. So what are they?
So Bobby, we make beautiful diamond rings, and try explaining that. I remember my very first, going in for my very first credit card into the bank to get a credit card. The business was tiny at the stage, and the bank manager told me at the time, shouldn't I just use my boyfriend's? And I remember we switched banks the next day and never looked back. The business is now in 60 countries with 60 people, but I think the skepticism over female-led businesses tends to focus around lifestyle, that women want to create beautiful, small businesses, and that it's harder as a woman to scale a global business, for sure, but still a really good challenge.
Okay, well, we'll come back to some of those things. Lisa, maybe we talk to you about the same sort of questions, advantages of being a woman in business, maybe.
I mean, I think one of the main advantages is we sell personal, you know, care, and women make those choices by and large for their families and for themselves. Our customers are primarily women. So I feel as a woman, I know my customer okay. So much more. I know how she feels. I know what she wants. And I feel like that connection when it comes to having a brand and in particular selling personal care is really, really important.
Does that exclude 50% of the marketplace then? So what about the other 50%?
No, and actually 40% of our customers in the US are actually male. But I think in terms of, you know, creating a change in an oral care industry that hasn't been innovated in so long, I think actually females and women doing it, I think is really important, because we can actually, you know, from a healthcare point of view, you know, we're used to treating obviously men and women, so we can look to what men need, but primarily it's women that make those choices when it comes to retail.
Okay. Vanessa, maybe we'd like to hear your views on that. Maybe some, do you have any thoughts about the disadvantages of being a woman in business?
I think Chupi alluded to it. I think now versus 10 years ago, there's been such a change and improvement in terms of women in business and equality and actually visualization of women in business and seeing that. And I think that's a testament to the women who've come before us and the huge players that they've been. I think women add such diversity in the boardroom and we bring a different skill set and unique thinking, and as do men, you know. And I think it's not about women being better than men, it's just bringing women to the areas that men have been traditionally and making that almost a level of playing field, so that when we are discussing and talking, we're all bringing our own unique insights to that. And then you just make better products, you make better brands, you deliver better services, because you're encompassing everyone, not just what you've inherently thought as a man or a woman.
Yeah, okay. Love to hear your views on it, Lulu O'Sullivan. Again, advantages. You've been in business a good number of years, like myself, and things have changed a lot, haven't they?
Yeah, definitely things have changed. So when I set up my business, there was no going for growth, which I know we're all involved in, which is just a massive support for women in business. It's incredible, and I wish I'd had something like that. Again, it's the network, you know, that you end up meeting, and there's always someone who you can pick up the phone to, and we are a minority, you know, there's no question about it. You know, I think for me, I just never let it in my head be a disadvantage, you know. It was just like, I'm doing this, I don't really care about what anyone else, you know. And so I wouldn't even see if there was a disadvantage, you know. If I was to pick one out, I would say definitely when we were raising money, I'm going to say 15 years ago or 14 years ago, you know, sitting in front of the VCs and the private equity people, particularly the VCs, it was just like
old boys club.
Yeah, and you knew walking out of the meeting, having spent 2 hours with them, you knew they weren't even taking you in the slightest bit seriously.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a proven concept at that stage and everything. And then the other one that used to really bug me, and still, no, it doesn't really happen anymore, but for the first 15 years of being in business, when you'd say to someone, you know, they'd say, what do you do? And I'd say, well, you know, I have my own business. Oh, would you run that from home? I was just like, I doubt a man has ever been asked that, but it was just an automatic assumption because I'm a woman, yeah. You know, that I run it. But like, you know, it's hard to fit 50 people into my kitchen, you know.
Well, could I maybe suggest that old boys club stuff? I totally agree with you that, you know, I've worked, and most in all the businesses that I've worked in were predominantly, there was way more women than men. And in my early days, all my bosses were female. And I never even, it never went into my head. And I just wonder sometimes when we bring in things like quotas and, you know, that we actually make it an issue, that we have to have a prescribed number of males or females in a particular scenario. Is that a bad thing? Or can it be a bad thing?
I think right now the challenge is so significant, we have to look at a way of changing it. 13% of women are on board level. 13%. That is a tiny proportion of what it should be. We're talking about 1 in 8 women are on board. So that's 7 men. Programs like Entrepreneur of the Year are starting to really think about that. It's fantastic. You see all the exceptional women this year, the exceptional women in the program. Bobby, we have to change top and bottom. It's not just a quota by itself isn't going to solve it. We need visibility, women and leader. We need better maternity and paternity. At Chupi, we do 26 weeks for our brilliant women, but we're also doing 13 weeks on paternity leave. And we'll be looking to match that by 2025 because we need to change the way the world of work works. My husband is here with me. We're both working as we should be with our daughter. And it's an amazing way of looking at the future. If we are always thinking we need to fit women into a man's world, that's not going to change anything. We need to make the world work for both parties.
Maybe I could ask you, Lisa, about, you know, you're all here and you're networking. And maybe networking is something that traditionally women didn't really do. But I think that's changed.
I think it's because opportunity has changed. I think when you walk into a room, it's hard to understand if you're not a woman walking into a room that's 90% men. You do a scan, you're looking for other women. I do that. And I think it's about representation, as Chupi said. You know, I feel more comfortable. And I actually was saying to Vanessa earlier, even with the EY, I feel a responsibility to return year after year because I want the next women to come in and scan the room and see, you know, 20%, 30% more women, that they feel like they're in the right place. So I think it's important to be seen and to see other women in business and networking.
And Vanessa, in terms of networking, is that something that you embrace, that you're comfortable with? What do you think of it? Or
yeah, I'm pretty comfortable networking with men and women, but I do see Lisa's point, and I think that's a very valuable point. You know, you do need to see that diversification and that in the room. And I think you bring up a really good point about quotas, and it's quite a controversial point. And it's something I go over and back in my mind about, do we really want quotas? Because are we minimizing the effect of those women who do get to that position? And I think it starts so much earlier than women leading boards. I think it starts actually at childcare. You know, it's women in the workforce in their late 20s, early 30s who start having kids. And the responsibility still lies on women to be the primary caregivers at home. And we really fundamentally, as a nation, need to change that. And I know childcare is such a huge issue. And it's a topic this week with the budget coming out. But fundamentally, if we really do want equality, we need to make childcare, make that primary caregiving more equal, because that's actually where we see the drop off in women in the workforce. And myself and Lisa always talk about it. We see women setting up companies before they've kids and after they've had kids, but you don't see many women having kids and starting businesses, but you do with men. So I think that's a fundamental pivot in someone's life. It's an inflection point that we really, really do need to address, because I think quotas are great, but we don't want to minimize the effect that women have at that level. You know, we don't want to play that down. Oh, she got there because there was a quota.
Yeah.
She got there because of her own hard work. And it's that judge, it's that pathway throughout their life that we do need to have those pivotal points in that woman's life where we're supporting her as opposed to pushing her into that primary caregiving role.
Yeah. Funny you say that, and I never really thought about this, but I started my business the day my fourth daughter was born, the very day, and there you go.
And I can guarantee your wife did not start your business on the fourth day your daughter was born. And that's actually a really, really important point.
Yeah,
you were able to start your business when you were fourth child, but she definitely wasn't, because someone has to mind the children. And it's such an important role, minding children. It shouldn't always land on women, but 95% of the time it does. It is really, really important, and I'm not dismissing that importance, but it is.
Okay. And I think it's about real conversation about having children and working and what that actually really looks like. And people talk about balance, and it's just kind of sometimes can be a bit of a nonsense conversation, you know what I mean? It's very busy, you're trying to do so many things. But I think when people hear that conversation over and over, it gives other women permission to do the same.
Okay. Last word to you, Lulu. Again, we've heard really good debate here and really good points of view, but ultimately what needs to change?
So, you know, it's a lot of things, and I would agree with all the other ladies here. You know, I do actually think quotas are going to have to be part of it. You know, it's not my first choice, but I think something drastic has to happen. I don't believe any board will put a woman on a board or in a management position that basically doesn't qualify to be there. You know, you just wouldn't do it. It's your business, you know. So we've tried it not without quotas, and it's not moving. The needle isn't moving. So I do think it's an absolute must, and I completely agree. I think the whole childcare and people having to give up work because they can't afford to, you know, they've no other choice, you know, it's too expensive, whatever. It just has to be, it has to be an open conversation within companies and also, obviously, in the wider space too.
Okay, thank you for a great debate, ladies. I'd like to thank my guests, Chupi Sweetman, Vanessa and Lisa Craven, and Lulu O'Sullivan. Thank you all so much for your contribution. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Down to business on Newstalk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland. We understand business. Choose the bank that's here to help you rise to today's business challenges and tomorrow's.
Now, we've had a really, really fantastic CEO retreat here in Killarney for the EY Entrepreneur of the Year programme. I'm delighted now just to sum things up, and you've heard it there over the last 2 hours, all the great guests we had, all the innovation that's happening, all the tenacity of entrepreneurs. But the managing partner of EY, our hosts and our friends here, is Frank O'Keefe, is just going to sum things up for us. Frank, we've had a pretty spectacular 3 days.
Yeah, it has been really spectacular, Bobby, and I'm really proud of the team and Roger and what our team does to support entrepreneurship on the island of Ireland. Bobby, you know, we've had the last few days with our current finalists, the alumni from our Entrepreneur of the Year programme, all entrepreneurs that have taken part in the previous years. We've had our judges, our sponsors, educators, thought leaders, master classes on many, many things over the last number of days. Actually, I think what's really important for the entrepreneurs here is that they've taken time out, special and precious time, out of their businesses, away from their families, to really think about their businesses, to learn about different things that are currently happening at a macro and more of a local Ireland perspective, to think about their businesses. But what really is the magic, Bobby, is not the formal program, it's the amount of time that we give the entrepreneurs to network and spend time. Why is that important? Well, what really happens in this retreat is that entrepreneurs from different sectors, different parts of our island, with different outlooks, they share issues that they've had so people can learn from those. But more importantly, they're all innovators. They all want to solve, they all want to find solutions, they all want to grow their business. They come together. They now start to venture together. They think about new businesses, new ideas. They do that, and what they're really doing is creating jobs. And creating jobs on the island of Ireland by our entrepreneurs, there is nothing more important. And it's incredibly purposeful for us in EY, as you know, our purpose is to build a better working world. And what better way to do that than to support entrepreneurship for the entrepreneurs to create value, create wealth, and most importantly, create jobs.
You've been at many of these, Frank. Indeed, you led this program for many years. Does this year feel any different with COVID and just the way the entrepreneurs have really faced up to it? Some of them are in better places than others. Some have done very well through COVID. But is it different this year?
Well, I think following the right guidelines here in Killarney has been very different for us. Actually, having the facility here, the access to a local market, has been unique this year. Normally we go around the world.
Yeah.
But I tell you, what's really key at the moment is, if we were to run this program here maybe 18 months ago, 12 months ago, 6 months ago, I think the mood might have been quite different.
Yeah.
Bobby, we're very respectful that the health pandemic, we needed to, you know, go through that last 18 months. And you're absolutely right. Certain businesses have not thrived. Certain businesses are on, you know, support. But an awful lot of others are thriving. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing here is the mood shifting. We're listening to entrepreneurs talking about new markets, talking about new products, new relationships, new supply chains, new customers, you know, sharing ideas of how they've moved their own business models. People are learning. There's a lot of ambition out there. There's actually a lot of positivity.
Yeah.
So overall, I think that the entrepreneurs are a phenomenal barometer for the confidence that we should have in our Indigenous economy.
Okay. And you mentioned COVID-19 there, and I just want to close up by asking you about your own, your firm, you and your own firm's role around the pandemic. You were heavily involved in some of the frontline initiatives. Maybe just share with our listeners some of the impacts COVID-19 had on EY.
Yeah, look, Bobby, you know, we started to really support our government and the nation around COVID-19 when we were trying to figure it out as a business ourselves. We were humbled to be asked to bring in one of our partners into the HSE, Niamh O'Byrne, to set up the test and tracing. There was no manual, so this was all very new. We, as a partnership and as a group of nearly 3,650 people, felt very privileged to be given that opportunity, and we have supported the HSE through many things, from our analytics specialists helping the frontline workers and hospitals, you know, have the right resources, the right ICU beds. We've helped out with the public-private partnership for the hospitals. We've supported the HSE. We've supported the Department of An Taoiseach with our one government centre all around, supporting them with data to make sure that they had the right information for them to make the right decisions around restrictions and moving through. And we've also done an awful lot in the north of Ireland. We're an all-island practice. We've helped set up the Nightingale Hospital. We were first to put our hands up to support and offer support. And, you know, I say that in a humble way. I say that in a very respectful way. It meant a huge amount to our people. It gave our people an awful lot of pride in EY that we were, you know, doing the right things in the marketplace through very tough times.
Yeah.
And it aligns fully with our purpose. And it's an opportunity for us in EY to truly give back and support our nation through probably the most difficult time that we will have known in our lifetime. So a huge privilege to do that. And, you know, really important that we were able to do it.
Well, look, as always, and I say this to you every year, thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
It's great to be in the room, getting into the access to all you mentioned there, the businesses, the learning, the entrepreneurs. It really is a spectacular program, and thanks very much.
Thanks to you and News Talk, Bobby. We really, really appreciate it. Thanks, John. Thanks,
cheers.
Bobby.
Frank O'Keefe of EY there, chatting to me about the EY Entrepreneur of the Year Annual CEO Retreat, which was held in the Europe Hotel here in Killarney, where I got to meet some great people this week. Now it's time for this.
News Talk's Executive Chair.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
Yes, for this week's Executive Chair, I'm bringing you David McRedmond, CEO of OnPost, who was one of the featured speakers at this year's event. Now I'm delighted to welcome to the programme the CEO of OnPost, Mr. David McRedmond. David, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, Bobby.
David, just I haven't seen you in a while, and the first thing I wanted to say to you was the role of OnPost during the pandemic. I'd suggest that it's something you're very proud of.
I'm immensely proud of it. I'm immensely humbled by it, because really it was our front lines. Now, I immediately say, look, they're not health workers, and the health workers are the front lines that put their lives at risk. But our front lines did a magnificent job. I couldn't be prouder of them. They came up with most of the ideas, and we just simply had to facilitate it and get out of the way as management. and make sure that they could do the job they like doing, which is serving customers and serving communities. I have to say this, it came totally naturally to them. Totally naturally. There wasn't a big initiative or big contrivance. Now, maybe what we had done in Unpust in the previous couple of years, you know, there was a greater clarity around what our purpose is, and we'd worked out our purpose is to act for the common good now and for generations to come. That's what we say. But you know what? Even if we hadn't said that, the postmen and postwomen of Ireland would have behaved the same way, which was magnificent.
But could I just say that does it not re-endorse the importance and the value of the post office within the community?
I think Unpust, you know, I'd like to think that we've done a lot of work reinventing ourselves, reinvigorating. I mean, previous management done a great job in the quality of networks and things, but I'd like to think we found purpose and we found real relevance. But boy, we didn't expect it to come true as strongly as it did during COVID. And that was with both front lines. It was also with the post offices, you know. And we're the only postal network in Europe that I'm aware of that kept 99% of its post offices open and 99% of its postal routes open right throughout the pandemic.
Tell me about the parcel side of the business. And, you know, obviously we could see, and I know from my own house, when the same lad from Unpust, he knows me by name, calls three times in the same day for the girls getting their various deliveries. But that piece of the business, and I know it probably has leveled out slightly since retail has reopened, but the complexity around the international parcels, can you maybe just tell our listeners in a kind of a non-technical way how all that works?
Sure. Well, look, first of all, I mean, we've reached an extraordinary volatility. So we've been growing e-commerce. We've been carefully planning it. We built out a parcel hub that would last us until the end of 2023 to give us time to find somewhere else. And then the pandemic hit and the lockdown hit and we were instantly at capacity. And the volumes just went up by 100% and then by another 100%. And we were absolutely jammers when it came to our Dublin parcel hub. And it was an incredibly difficult position. I mean, we were close to overtrading. That's a very expensive way to serve parcels. So the amount of people involved, we had the automation. But, you know, I'm really, really pleased that we managed to keep trading open. And it was as important as this, that anything that was non-grocery that Ireland needed in a lockdown, we delivered.
Yeah.
And that was really important. The international aspect now has got really complicated.
That's what
because the world's got more complicated because of customs deals and EU deal. And mainly it's around new EU customs regime. And it was a regime, I think, principally brought in relation to goods coming from outside the EU and largely coming in from China. But of course then, Brexit meant that Britain had suddenly put itself out of the EU, and so it's affected by the same rules. Ireland is particularly affected because of the amount of trade we have with Britain. So, you know, those supply chains have got really complex, massive data requirements, massive number of restrictions and complexity. But, you know, we've worked our way through it. It was very, very difficult. It was introduced in July for postal. We've worked our way through it, and it's starting to come through fairly well. I should add, Bobby, particularly for your listeners, that this doesn't affect 80% of our parcels.
Right.
Anything that you order from a big e-tailer, you know, M&S or Boohoo.com or Amazon or all of them, we put all the systems in place for them, and all of that works. The difficulty is with small companies who we don't know and who mightn't yet know in the UK or elsewhere outside the EU might know what they have to do, how they have to code things. So that's where the complexity is. But we're working fantastically. Amazing teams working day and night. So I think we're getting through that.
A couple of other things I wanted to talk again positively, to look at new opportunities that might be out there on post money. What about the services maybe to SMEs? A lot of people working from home now. Is there a role there for the post office in providing stationery and things that people may need around their business?
It's funny. I was just looking yesterday at Debbie Byrne, who's managing director of the retail business, and they were just sharing plans and looking at things like stationery, like gifting, like those pieces. So absolutely there's more services, and you know, we are bringing on more services. Obviously agency banking, where we do the banking for Bank of Ireland, and for AIB and for Ulster Bank, that's really important. And that's, you know, means in most communities, we're now the people providing the banking services. But I think for SMEs, that's also really important to have good banking services. Good cash services matter to SMEs. Yeah. That really matters to them. But we can now extend out a whole range of services to SMEs, and we're doing that. We've built up the digital side of our business. We've built the digital ecosystem. So we're really just starting this now, and I think you're going to see this grow quite rapidly over the next year or two.
And you mentioned the role there of the agency banking and the role that it's now providing and the need for cash. Is there a business in being the last man standing on cash, as in the only provider of cash in a village, in a town?
Well, look, I think there is. I think as part of a business, as part of a business mix on its own, you know, we're not an ATM on its own, that's not sufficient. But as part of a mix of other services, and also, you know, come back to what we call it, you know, we say we're human about money, that really matters. And it matters, I tell you where it really matters. It matters to people who are trading, to retailers. And by the way, we're huge supporters of Irish retailers, which of course aren't affected at all by the customs issues within Ireland. So if you really want to be really sure of your purchases, purchase from an Irish retailer online or yeah. purchase from the EU. So I think that really matters to them. So look, it's part of a business mix. Like any business, no one line of business is sufficient in itself.
Let me ask you one more question about you know, going green. We hear a lot of this greenwashing. We hear a lot of people talking about sustainability. You ordered 700 new electric vans. What difference has that made to your green credentials as a business?
Well, it means we've brought forward our target to halve our emissions to 2025, and it means we've brought forward our target to have to be net zero carbon by 2030. It was 2050. That's because a most vast proportion of our carbon output is from our fleets. So we've managed to do it on the last mile fleet, the vans you see everywhere. It's much more difficult actually on the heavy goods vehicle fleets yeah. because they're not really, there's not a robust electric vehicle yet, certainly not mass produced. But we are and have started really good experiments, and we're the first with this, with hydrogenated biofuel that can actually work in our existing vehicles.
Okay.
And we're testing that. We've got that in Galway. I think the phrase is we have to bunker it. We have to, because nobody else is using it. So we've a lot of work to do around that. But the heavy goods vehicle fleet, if we get that piece done, then we really have absolutely decimated our carbon emissions. And then we're doing some work around property and elsewhere. That's the most important piece in climate, but it's about how we bring it into the community, whether it's through green hubs and post offices where you can go in and you can get a real end-to-end service in terms of refurbishing your home to eco standards. That really matters. And there's a whole load of other initiatives.
More bicycles.
I love bicycles. I love postman's bicycles. But it's tough if you're having to deliver a children's slide at a bicycle.
All right. Well, listen. Thanks for letting us into your world, David. Great to talk to you today. Haven't seen you a while, as I said. So delighted to see the business is going forward with such gusto. So good to hear you today.
Fantastic to talk with you, Bobby. And thank you very much.
Now, I'm afraid that's all we got time for from our special show from this year's EY Entrepreneur of the Year CEO Retreat. A huge thanks to the Europe Hotel and particularly Finbar Casey. Thanks to all in EY and in particular to Emer Rigney. Thanks to our series producer and my old friend and travel companion, Mr. John Fardy, and also to Simon Keane and Garrett Mulhall back at base. That's all we have for this week. Back to normal next week. Goodbye from the beautiful, beautiful Killarney.